From the Danker Studio on Library Square, this is The Rundown, an exploration of local news, events, and issues that matter to you. I'm Roger McDonough. Today we'll get a recap of what happened up at the state capitol today with Marianne Martindale, executive director of the nonprofit Good Government Group Alliance for a Better Utah.
So Utahns are in favor of a non-discrimination ordinance. The LDS Church has come out and essentially endorsed the Salt Lake City ordinance. There's not really a lot, there's no reason other than them choosing not to see this forward to hear this bill.
Plus, we'll speak with two Yale University law professors about the opinion piece they published in the Washington Post, pointing out the similarities between a Russian anti-gay law and laws in various U.S. states, including Utah. All that and your summary of the day's top local headlines just ahead on The Rundown here on KCPW. First up, we have these messages and Access Downtown. We're joined now by Marianne Martindale, executive director of the nonprofit Good Government Group Alliance for a Better Utah, for our Better Utah legislative recap. We do this daily here on KCPW. Marianne, you know, there was a lot going on the Hill today, but I thought we should focus on the events that you witnessed having to do with a protest up at the Capitol today. What was that all about?
Yeah, it's a little different. I have to say that in the years that I've been up there and in talking to other people who've been up there for even more years than I, no one's ever seen this happen. We had 13 people arrested today for protesting. And it was an act of civil disobedience. It was very interesting to watch. It was sort of like a civics lesson in action.
What were the protesters there doing? What was their demeanor and what were they trying to get accomplished?
So these were LGBT and LGBT allies. So in other words, lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender and their allies protesting the refusal of the legislature to hear SB 100, which is Senator Urquhart's non-discrimination ordinance bill. So their frustration is that despite the fact that this is the sixth year this bill has been up, last year it got a committee hearing and actually passed out of committee hearing, that this year they refused to even hear it again in committee. And so their demand was that they wanted a commitment by Senate President Wayne Niederhauser that that bill would be heard in committee. Not a commitment that it would be passed, not a commitment that it would be enforced, just a commitment that it would be heard and the public would have an opportunity to participate in the process of vetting that bill.
Where were they located in the Capitol complex? And maybe walk us through the events of
sure.
the day with the protesters.
Sure. So, I mean, it was interesting. So they started in front of the governor's office. And this is kind of largely more of a symbolic place for them to do this. They blocked entrance, the main door entrance to the governor's office. There are other door entrances to the governor's office. In fact, the entire Capitol, you can access every room without ever going through any public area, which is, you know, something interesting. I don't think people realize. So staff was still able to essentially do their business. And they stood there and they were told by, they had an attorney general, an assistant attorney general, Alan Bachman, come over and very loudly, essentially yelled at them that they had no business being there and then they had to move and this wasn't the right way to do this and so forth. It didn't get really anywhere. It was not the most effective way to communicate with people who were, you know, genuinely concerned about this bill and very frustrated. The troopers were, you know, cordial to them. I mean, it was very cordial. It was very civil. Everyone was very respectful of what the roles were and what everyone should be doing. There was no chanting. There was no singing. There was no pushing or anything. They just locked arms and stood in front of the door and said, "We will move when we have a commitment from Senate President Wayne Niederhauser that SB 100 will get a hearing."
And that went on through the lunchtime period and beyond, right?
Yeah, it went until about 1:45, at which point they moved to the second floor of the Senate building, where Senator Wayne Niederhauser, again, the Senate president, was going to be joining a committee at 2 o'clock. And they linked arms and blocked the entrance to the committee room. There's three doors. They broke into two groups and blocked all three of the doors. Locked arms. We're not going to move. Senator Reed, actually, is the one that came trying to get into the committee room. He's also a member of that committee. It's Senate Education Committee.
This is Stuart Reed.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, Senator Stuart Reed from Weber. He was not very pleased with it. He was clearly upset. And he said, "Well, I'll be back with troopers." State troopers in Utah are the same thing as Highway Patrol. They're assigned to guard and administer the law on the state capitol.
Right.
So they came back and they informed them that they would need to move. And they said, "We will not move." Again, it was very respectful. They said, with all due respect to your job, we're blocking this committee because we have been blocked from a committee of our own. We will move when we have Senate President Wayne Niederhauser's commitment to hear the bill." They wouldn't, you know, obviously couldn't give that thing. And Senator Niederhauser was nowhere to be seen during any of this. So John Fellows, who's the head of Ledge Research, in other words, the legal expert for the legislature, he appeared and he had a code book with him and he read off two or three different sections of code that he was advising them that they were in violation of. And he said, "I give you one more chance. You can move or you will be arrested." And they again, you know, stated their demand once again. And so then they were turned around and zip ties on their hands, and they were led out through a side door.
13 people arrested.
13 people.
And was that the size? I mean, was that the totality of the protest group?
Yeah, there were a few extras. There were people who were making sure that purses and coats. I mean, when you get arrested, you don't think about, well, who's going to gather up my stuff. So there were a few other people who were helping out. There were people that were taking video and making sure that pictures and making sure things were being handled okay. But that was the bulk of it. They were probably at the highest. Maybe 20 or so at the biggest time.
You know, one question that I haven't asked is who were these protesters, if you know?
I know some of them. The protest was led by Troy Williams. And there was also Donna Weinholz, Gail Turpin, Michelle Turpin, her stepdaughter, and then, you know, another, what, 8 or 9 people. But, I mean, it was just a mix. But, I mean, they were all very professionally put together. They came on, you know, with a very clear message. They knew what they wanted to say, and they were prepared to take responsibility for the actions that they were doing.
And these are people, as you mentioned, who want to see SB 100 heard in committee, the non-discrimination bill that has had how many? Six?
This would be the sixth year. It's very frustrating for people, you know, of this community and supporters of this community. Plus, I think one of the most frustrating things, this is one of the things that they kept reiterating, is 72% of Utahns in 3 different polls, including a BYU poll, have said, we support this. So Utahns are in favor of a non-discrimination ordinance. The LDS Church has come out and essentially endorsed the Salt Lake City ordinance. There's not really a lot – there's no reason other than them choosing not to see this forward to hear this bill.
You know, I know that Senator Jim DeBacchus, he's the head of the Democratic Party here in Utah, released a statement in support of the protesters saying that he understands their frustration and the frustration of so many Utahns. I guess I'm wondering if you think this will have an effect on whether or not the legislature will actually consider hearing this legislation this year.
Well, I think civil disobedience serves a lot of purposes. I don't know that any of those protesters went there today thinking they were going to sway the Senate into hearing SB 100. I mean, I think, you know, there's a certain reality to that. They've said no. They've said no repeatedly. Again, 6 years of saying no. But I think what they wanted to show was their commitment to this. You know, that this is a commitment. I mean, this is a big decision to make. You know, when you march in there and you know I may be walking out in handcuffs, you know, you really have to think of what your actions are going to cause. Is it going to affect my job? You know, is this going to cause other problems for me? Am I willing to be arrested for the courage of my convictions? And I think that goes to the very core of what civil disobedience is. I mean, it's interesting that, you know, this is Black History Month. And so we look back how many years. And this is where we saw this happen in the country. I mean, our country has a long history of civil disobedience. And so it's just another opportunity for citizens to say, enough, we're done. We've heard it. We hear the same lip service year over year. And this is it. We're going to sit here until you listen to us.
Well, it sounds like a fascinating chain of events up at the Capitol today. And we'll count on you to keep us apprised on more of the doings from the state capitol this year. Marianne Martindale, Executive Director of Alliance for Better Utah, thanks once again for joining us.
Thank you.
And now on The Rundown, we're joined by Ian Ayers and William Eskridge, two Yale University law professors who wrote an opinion piece in The Washington Post recently concerning a Russian law that forbids, quote, propaganda of non-traditional sexual practices, unquote, among minors. The law has come to represent the repression of gay rights in Russia, and especially in the run-up to the Winter Olympic Games in Sochi. Gentlemen, thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you, Roger.
Pleasure to be here.
And it sounds like the connection we have with you two is a little bit spotty. Hopefully our audience will bear with us. In my introduction, I left out the heart of what you wrote in your Washington Post opinion piece, because the way you wrote it meant that there was a reveal that was kind of a surprise. So for just one second, let's talk about the law in Russia, what it is, and what it does.
Sure. Well, it's hard to believe that a modern civilized government could have enacted provisions that prohibit the advocacy of homosexuality or propaganda of homosexuality, that say that no district shall promote a homosexual lifestyle, or that mandate that teachers provide in a factual manner that homosexuality is not a lifestyle acceptable to the general public.
And what you're describing there is the Russian law banning the promotion of homosexuality?
The big reveal, though, is that only the second of those four provisions come from Russia. It's actually our own state of Utah that prohibits the advocacy of homosexuality, and it's Arizona that prohibits teachers from portraying homosexuality as a positive alternative lifestyle.
Wow. Okay. And so the implication of your article is that America's being a little bit hypocritical when it comes to its criticisms of this law in Russia.
Well, Roger, the way we prefer to put it, this is Bill Eskridge, is that both kinds of laws are highly objectionable in the modern era. There's been all of this criticism from the West, including the United States, of the Russian law. And the point of our op-ed in the Post was to point out that there are a lot of American laws that have the very same flaw that we're criticizing in the Russian law. And so in fairness, we should be self-critical as well as Russia-critical.
You know, on that point, I want to play a clip here of President Obama explaining why the U.S. delegation to the Olympics was represented so strongly by openly gay athletes. Here he is speaking to NBC's Bob Costas last week.
Well, there's no doubt that we wanted to make very clear that we do not abide by discrimination in any forms, including discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation. And you know, one of the wonderful things about the Olympics is that you are judged by your merit, you know, how good you are, regardless of where you come from, what you look like, who you love. And that, I think, is consistent with the spirit of the Olympics. It is certainly consistent with American values, and we want to make sure that people understand that.
Ian Ayres and William Eskridge, are comments like that, or are moves like that, I guess, somewhat hypocritical given the state of the laws in the various states that you guys describe in your opinion piece? Though I suppose you would say those apply to states and not the entire country.
Well, Roger, we want to make a couple of distinctions here. In support of President Obama, it should be said that the Obama administration has been very gay-friendly and is not to be associated with the laws in Texas, Alabama, Utah, and Arizona. Whereas in Russia, President Putin has put the entire nation behind its law. And it's also important to note that the law in Russia is a criminal law. The laws that we talk about in our op-ed that are American laws are admonitions to educators in Utah and these other states that they should not advocate homosexuality. Homosexuality is a positive lifestyle, and so on and so forth. On the other hand, though, the American laws are in some ways worse. Because one of the American laws that we criticize says that the state is supposed to instruct young people that homosexual sex is contrary to the laws of the state. Yet since 2003, no state can constitutionally prosecute anybody for engaging in private consensual intercourse between two adults. And so in some ways, the American laws are worse because they're more fallacious. But in other ways, they're not as bad.
So some of this has to do with our federalist system. The Supreme Court striking down anti-sodomy laws is what you're referring to, right?
Yes, that's right.
Okay, but your piece argues that there's still much to be desired when it comes to the laws that are on the books here in the United States. How do these laws, like the one here in Utah, you know, match up or stack up against the U.S. Constitution?
Well, we end the op-ed with that observation that the laws that we're talking about in Utah, Alabama, Texas, Arizona, they're still on the books. They should be repealed. If they're not repealed, they should be invalidated at some point by a federal court or even by state courts. To the extent that these laws are enforced, and we don't take any position on the day-to-day enforcement of these state statutes, they are, we think, blatantly unconstitutional for the same reasons that a lot of the other anti-gay laws that have been struck down are unconstitutional. They set out gay and lesbian people as second-class citizens and require the state to demonize and encourage animus against those citizens. And that's at the very heart of the Equal Protection Clause and is unconstitutional.
You know, both Russia and these states are on the wrong side of history. You know, back in 1991, when Vladimir Putin was resigning from the Communist Party, that's when Arizona passed this anti-gay law. But it's amazing how fast things have changed, not just for the Soviet Union politically, but how much gay rights has been on the move. Equality has been on the move. In 2002, we happily and without comment sent our Olympic winter athletes to Utah, a state that had this anti-advocacy law. But no longer is this going to, this will not stand for much longer. And just as we're seeing with state after state embracing marriage equality, it's time for these states and Russia to start getting on the right side of history.
You know, Professor Eskridge, you brought up the idea of animus, and we have a debate going on right now at our state legislature, and Republican leaders in this legislature are arguing that the state shouldn't take up any legislation having to do with LGBT issues because the state could end up showing animus, which might affect pending court cases, specifically the court case in the appellate court in Denver. I'm actually not certain what my question is here. I guess I'm wondering if the laws on the book already show animus or...
I have to think it's a very good question for the following reason. The Utah legislators should be worried. And the reason they should be worried is that it's very hard to defend exclusion of lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender Americans from marriage or education or jobs or any of these things, because it's very hard to find any kind of rational basis for excluding a group of people. And almost any kind of explanation tends to look stereotypical or even based upon prejudice, because there are no data, very few experiences, no traditionally defined rational basis for these kinds of exclusions. So that's why they're worried, and they should be worried.
The silence is becoming increasingly their best strategy, because any proposed justification doesn't pass the red face test.
Hey, you know, in Russia, in the lead up to the Olympic Games in Sochi, Vladimir Putin made the case that it was fine, everybody was welcome as long as they kind of stayed away from the children. And essentially, that's mirrored in these laws that you're talking about. You know, how historical is that argument? How rooted in our society is the idea that homosexuals are somehow a threat to our children?
Well, historically, Roger, the core basis for anti-gay animus and stereotyping is the notion of lesbians and gay people as sterile, selfish, and predatory. The argument is that because lesbian and gay people cannot reproduce inter se, therefore, they want to recruit your child, the heterosexual child. That is a stereotype that is inaccurate. Lesbian and gay people do procreate. Lesbian and gay people are no more selfish than other Americans. It's also a basis in prejudice. On the other hand, there is a deeper and slightly less vicious thing going on with many people. And that is a lot of parents do view their adolescent children as wavering adolescents hovering on the cusp between heterosexuality and grandchildren and homosexuality and all of the problems that the parents see with that. Now, this is not a sensible way of viewing parenthood, perhaps, or one's adolescent children, but this is a common view of many parents. And the state statutes we're talking about, such as Utah's, probably represent this kind of parental anxiety that is very common still in America among people who are not violent, gay-bashing homophobes, but more what I would call homo-anxious parents.
If Putin really wants to protect children, he should teach them that when they grow up, they can choose whom to love without fear of harassment.
You know, there's been some criticism of your piece. I think it was in Slate or Salon this morning. I can't remember which. Essentially, the argument was that these laws in U.S. states are geared at school curricula and that the law in Russia is far more wide sweeping and can engender greater violence than anything that happens in the United States. Do you want to address that?
Well, here's what we'd say about that. We should issue a caveat that there's not survey evidence that very rigorous for Russia, demonstrating a connection between the law and anti-gay violence. There was a lot of anti-gay violence before this law. But what we can say is this, certainly in the United States, there is a lot of violence against lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgendered youth. There's a lot of bullying, and this is documented. The level of suicide among lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgendered adolescents is astronomical. It is much higher than the level of suicide for other adolescents. Now, what causes this, and what causes this most clearly, is the drumbeat of hateful, negative attitudes. And we don't argue that the education system is the only source of these attitudes, but for the education system to tie into these and encourage these attitudes and to retard teachers from making an effort to prevent these attitudes, which is exactly what the Utah, Alabama, Texas, Arizona statutes purport to do, this is deeply wrong and contributes in that significant way to the anxiety of gay and lesbian adolescents and to the bullying and violence that has been documented against them. So these laws have a connection to real and vicious effects.
And the point of our op-ed was not to argue that Russia's enforcement is just the same, that things are equally bad in Russia as in the United States, but it is to say that these U.S. state statutes are a green light in that they stop teachers from intervening in teachable moments, or they mandate the teachers actually lie to their students by saying that homosexuality is not an acceptable alternative lifestyle, or to lie and say that it's a criminal offense when it's not.
I appreciate that response. Gentlemen, we've taken up a lot of your time, and we are now out of time. But I want to thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us. We've been speaking with Ian Ayers and William Eskridge from the Yale University School of Law, who wrote an opinion piece on this issue in the Washington Post. We'll put a link on our website. Gentlemen, thanks again. And thanks again for tuning in to KCPW's News and Issues show, The Rundown. Our program was produced by Lauren Colucci. We had additional help from Jesse Ellis, Ryan Cunningham, and Mr. Tyler Ford. Our theme music was composed by Tim Myers. Tune in each weekday at 5 p.m. for an exploration of local news, events, and issues that matter to you. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for listening. The Utah Business Report and Marketplace are next.